The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this, the 25th day of May, 2025, Memorial Day weekend. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is at the ready behind the glass. I'm glad you could join us tonight. We have got a great show lined up for you. First, we'll welcome in the great knuckleballer and Cy Young Award winner, R.A. Dickey, will join us. And in the second half, we'll switch gears and welcome in South Setauket's own, the great singer-songwriter, Leslie Mendelson. She'll be appearing at the Stephen Talk House out in Amagansett next week. So sit back, relax, enjoy the show tonight. We've got some great talk up ahead for you. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page, which is called The Talk of New York Sports. There's show information, sports information, great pictures, so much more. So stop by, take a look. You can also follow me on X at B Donahue WGBB, all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're out on the website the next day. You can listen to them whenever you want. Catch up anytime. Well, our first guest, he is one of a rare breed, and by that we mean he threw the knuckleball. Not only that, but he threw it with a great degree of success. We remember him as the Cy Young Award winner in the National League in 2012, as, of course, a New York Met. We're very happy to have him join the show tonight. Welcome to Sports Talk New York, R.A. Dickey. R.A., good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you aboard, R.A. Now, growing up in Tennessee, who were your sports heroes and favorite teams back then?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, we had basically two options. It was WGN, the Chicago Cubs, or TBS for the Atlanta Braves. And so, you know, on any given day, one of those two teams were my favorite. But I grew up watching, you know, Greg Maddux and Dale Murphy and, you know, that era of baseball. I could probably name a lot of the Atlanta Braves from the 80s and the Cubs from the 80s. Sean Dunston, Andre Dawson, like those guys were kind of the guys I followed.
Good guys, IRA, that's for sure. Now, you were drafted by the Tigers in 1993. You didn't sign. You went on to play for the Volunteers in Tennessee. How was your college career?
Well, I certainly enjoyed it. You know, I didn't feel like when I got drafted out of high school I was ready to go out and be on my own. I felt like I needed some more seasoning, both as a human being and as a player. So, you know, I found myself, you know, heading to the University of Tennessee. And it was a good decision for me because I ran into some really, really good coaching. I got in a strength program, involved in a strength program that really helped kind of cultivate my velocity and my ability to pitch. And I went from being a 10th rounder in high school to a first rounder in out of college. And so I'd say it was, you know, fruitful for me. You know, everybody's different, but I certainly enjoyed my time. I went to the College World Series in 1995 and had a great time there. So it was a wonderful experience.
Good decision, R.A. Yes, that certainly worked out for you. Now, you were an English lit major. I'd just like to ask you, who are your favorite writers and some of your favorite works?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I love American, like American coming of age stories. You know, I grew up, you know, Huck Finn, and, you know, there's Bryce Courtney wrote a book called The Power of One, which is a great book that I love. I mean, just really anything. Like, I was a big Hemingway fan, love Ernest Hemingway. For who the classics, I kind of came up on the classics for my education in high school and my concentration in college was around that. So just really enjoy the written word, always have, the power of story, the power of experience, You know, so I would connect with any book where you saw growth in the characters, and you know, it was always a great outlet for me.
Nice answer. All right, that's for sure. Now, R. A. Dickey's with us tonight on the program. You also played with Team USA in the Atlanta Olympics. How was that experience, R. A.?
Well, that was incredible. Yeah, you know, that's another thing that going to college allowed me to do. It allowed me to represent my country in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and we won the bronze medal, which really, for us, it sounds great, but we were a little bit disappointed because we thought we had an incredible team, a team that could win the gold medal. So when we got beat by we got beat by Japan, actually, to get into the gold medal game, it was kind of, you know, heartbreaking because we thought that, you know, we were going to be facing Cuba in that gold medal game. Mm-hmm. But we ended up competing for the bronze and winning it. And that was also kind of a bittersweet year because, you know, we had the bombing down there in Atlanta. So that kind of put a little bit of a stain on some of the experience. But all in all, you know, it was a fantastic, just a journey for me. The Olympic journey for me was great. I played all three summers on the USA Olympic team and got to meet great competitors, great people, and learned a lot.
Another good experience. Yeah, that sounds great, R.A. Now, as you say, you were drafted by the Texas Rangers in the first round, 18th overall, which is great. Now, all of a sudden, the Texas Rangers find out that you don't have an ulnar collateral ligament in your elbow. What happened there?
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you, to be honest. I you know, I still don't have that ligament in there. I think when I was drafted, no one knew that I had a pre-existing condition in my elbow. I'd never been hurt a day in my life, never missed a start. And so when the Rangers drafted me, there was no reason for them to think that, you know, I had any kind of condition in there. And when I went through my comprehensive MRI before I signed my contract, they made the discovery that that Tommy John ligament, that ligament, that UCL ligament that most people have to have replaced, I didn't have it. Now, I argued that I should get more money because they'd never have to replace it, but they didn't.
Right.
They didn't see it that way, and I ended up signing for far less than what we had originally agreed upon because of that condition.
Well, that makes the fact that you could carry on pitching really remarkable, and that's something folks should note about R.A.'s career. That's something real interesting. Now, your debut was in 2001. You had your fastball, your breaking ball, and a forkball, which you called the Thing. Tell us about that pitch.
Well, yeah, you know, it was basically just a hard knuckleball that I threw, and I would hold it a little bit unconventional for a knuckleball, so people didn't really know what to call it. And I think Joe Morgan on Sunday Night Baseball one night gave it that moniker when I was pitching against the Boston Red Sox. But, you know, for me, it was just a modified kind of forkball, knuckleball-type pitch, and it came out fairly hard, but it was kind of the genesis of what I would later turn into my knuckleball once I changed from being a full-time conventional pitcher to a full-time knuckleball pitcher. Back in 2005, that was kind of the foundation of what I based my knuckleball on. And everybody's different. You know, there's been a lot of knuckleballers out there. Well, not a lot, but there's been every knuckleballer, I should say, has his own personality with the pitch. And mm-hmm. mine was just that I threw it very, very hard.
And that's different, R.A., from a guy like Wakefield or even Phil Niekro.
Sure. Yeah, those guys were incredible to me, like, because those were my mentors. You know, I went to visit Charlie Huff, I went to visit Tim Wakefield, I went to visit Phil Niekro. All of those guys were like my, you know, I call them my Jedi Council of knuckleballer guys. You
right.
know, I mean, they were the ones that really, when I needed something answered, those are the guys I called. And I was real fortunate and blessed that they were so generous with their wisdom and their time. And, you know, there wasn't a time when I called where they didn't either call me back or pick up. And, you know, it's hard for a pitching coach at any major league level to coach a knuckleball. So there's very few people that have walked the earth that throw that pitch. And so I would lean on those guys quite a bit after starts that didn't go well or after a game that I didn't feel good in. You know, I would send them some video, and again, they were just incredibly generous with just their feedback and their time. And if it weren't for those men, I would not have cultivated my knuckleball as well as I did because of what they taught me.
Now, as you say, R.A., it must have been difficult for those guys to come along and give you some advice because, as you say, everybody grips it differently. Wilbur Wood gripped it different than Hoyt Wilhelm and guys like that. And how did you grip it?
Well, you know, I had a funny grip, and then and I had, you know, a modicum of success as a minor leaguer when I was trying to figure out the pitch. And it's very difficult to go from being a conventional pitcher to trying to be a full-time knuckleball pitcher. It's almost like you have to unlearn the things that you learned as a conventional pitcher and relearn a mechanic that can produce a ball that doesn't spin out of your hand. I mean, a conventional pitcher's life is bent on trying to spin the ball certain ways to manipulate the movement and the break. And so now I was being asked to subtract spin completely so that ball would have a very erratic movement to it. And my grip was very unconventional. And so when I went to L.A. to meet with Charlie Huff, that's the very first thing that he changed about me, was switching my grip I threw it kind of with what I call the runway of the baseball, which is along the two seams, to behind the horseshoe of the baseball. If you turn the baseball a certain way, it looks like a horseshoe. I would put my fingernails right in behind that horseshoe, and that was the grip change that Charlie Huff made for me, and it proved to be successful. It was a good change, and from there I moved on to Tim Wakefield, who taught me something else about a mechanic that helped, and then I moved from Tim Wakefield to Phil Niekro, who kind of gave me that final piece that I felt like I needed to really be consistent. And thankfully, they all came along at the right time in my development, because had I not gone to Charlie or Tim first, I don't think I would have understood what Phil was trying to tell me. So it was very, you know, my journey was very fortuitous in the sense that, you know, I had a lot of really good men pouring into me.
You sure did. Now, the record that you tied for most wild pitches in an inning, folks, that's four, in case you're wondering. Other guys that accomplished that feat, we'll say accomplished, was, of course, Phil Niekro, a knuckleballer. And here's what surprised me. What surprised me, R.A., is that Walter Johnson was the other guy who had four wild pitches. I mean, maybe that's because he was wild, because he threw hard.
Yeah, you know, that. Well, the knuckleball can be funny. And you know, Bob Uecker has the best quote, I think, of about catching a knuckleball, right? Like, the best way to catch it is to wait till it stops rolling and go pick it up. And that's a lot of times that's kind of how it was. I set that record in the Metrodome when the Twins played in the Metrodome, and I was with the Twins. And I had the best knuckleball I think I've ever had. The catcher couldn't catch it. I couldn't throw it for strikes. I think I also had three passed balls in that same inning. I don't think I gave up a hit and gave up like two earned runs, because I just couldn't control it because it was moving so much. And that's the nature of that pitch. That's the thing that makes it both hard to hit and hard to control. So that was, most of my career was spent on how to control this uncontrollable pitch.
The success that you were after with the knuckleball really seemed to come to you when you joined the Mets. What happened there? What can you attribute that to, R.A.?
Well, you know, it was right. It was the year before I went to go see Phil Niekro, and I think Phil really, you know, Phil was a good friend of mine, and you know, I still miss him today. I think about him often, but he gave me that final piece I felt like I needed to put it all together, and that was just, and my mechanic, I really got my hips involved in a way I never had before. And he always said, hey, man, he said, listen, if I could throw my knuckleball as hard as you could, and this is a Hall of Famer who won over 300 games, right, was telling me if he could do something that I could do. And I was thinking, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, I never had the arm strength that you do to be able to throw that pitch that hard. And so you need to start doing that. That needs to be kind of your hallmark. And I really embraced that right in like 2010, and And that's when things started to really take off for me, is I embraced my own personality and identity with the pitch. Instead of trying to be Phil Niekro or Charlie Hough or Tim Wakefield, I just took what they gave me and then added it to the thing that I could do well. And there you have it. You know, that's the piece I needed and the confidence I needed to kind of go out there and be consistent with that pitch.
Right. And as you say, taking advice from a 300-game winner who was around as long as Phil Niekro was and strike out as many batters as he did, yeah, you got to be doing something right. That's for sure. Now, in 2012, R.A., that was your Cy Young season. And you really drew comparisons to some of the most dominating pitchers with your streak. And like manager Terry Collins said, he'd never seen anything like it, the domination that you showed. And Phil Niekro happened to, folks, have a quote about R.A. He said he had a few streaks, but nothing like he's going through. I don't know if any other knuckleball has ever been on a hot streak like he's been. He is just dynamite right now. Pretty great words from Nuxie there.
Yeah, you know, he was so kind. And Terry was too. Terry was one of my favorite managers I ever played for, and you know, we had a great relationship. That's part of the reason I felt like I was able to thrive in New York, was he understood me and I understood him, and we were always honest with each other, and that really motivated me to want to run through brick walls for that guy. He was special to me. I just had a year where it just all came together. You know, everybody, all these, you know, you hear athletes talk about being in a zone. I was just in a year-long zone, and all I cared about was getting to the field and getting to my work. And I just really consumed myself with that. And it wasn't that it was so much different from the years before. I felt like I had really good years in 2010 and 11. I could feel it building into something. I don't think that I really could have comprehended at the end of the 2011 season that I would strike out so many guys. You know, I mean, that was the big thing in 2012 that was different from every season I played, was just how many guys I was striking out that year. And it was just because I had such a great feel for the pitch. I never missed a bullpen. I was always had that ball in my hand all the time. I never wanted, you know, I would drive home from the park and just be handling the baseball as I was driving, just because I didn't want that feel to ever leave.
Yeah.
And I was able to get through that 162-game season with the feeling, really, outside of like maybe one or two starts, I felt like I had that feel all year. And I think it was just the consistency of work. I mean, like getting to the park, knowing my routine, being military about how I went about my work, and that really helped me stay in that zone and stay in that place where, you know, I felt like I was unhittable at certain times. I mean, the back-to-back one-hitters that I threw in 2012, you know, I felt like I could have thrown two no-hitters back-to-back. You know, I mean, I felt that good with the pitch.
The only other guys to do that, folks, as a sidelight, Sandy Koufax and Nolan Ryan. So not such bad company there. And as a side note, R.A., I'd just like to say that coming to the Mets, Terry Collins came into his own, too, as a manager. Really a good man, as you say, a good baseball man and a good guy in general. Now, You win the Cy Young Award that year, the first knuckleballer to win the award, which is kind of amazing that Niekro never won it. The third Met to win the Cy Young Award, of course, Seaver and Doc Gooden the other. Now, Josh Tolley, we've had Josh on the show. He was kind of like your personal catcher. And what made you choose Josh, or how did he fit into that role so well?
Man, I don't know if it's really that I chose him. I think we were just kind of destined to be together. You know, the kudos are his and his alone. I mean, he pursued me. He wanted to play catch with me every day. He did not want. He knew that it was a hard pitch for catchers to catch, and he didn't want that to ever be an excuse for why he might not play a game, is that he couldn't catch me. And so there were other catchers who didn't really work at it and weren't very good at it. And Josh didn't have that kind of ego. I mean, he took his ego completely out of it. He wanted to learn everything he could about it. He played catch with me every day. He caught every bullpen. and we became so intimate with each other on the baseball field that there were times when he didn't even have to give me a sign. Like, he just knew what I wanted to throw, and I would throw it, and he would catch it. And he just was really, really good and relaxed behind the plate, and we just had a real good dynamic. I mean, for the years that I played, I bet he probably, you know, I guess I won however many games I won, I bet he was part of 80% of them, just because of how much we played together and with each other. But he was fantastic in every way, and I really enjoyed him as a teammate.
Yeah, great catcher for the knuckleball. That's definitely for sure. Now, you go to Toronto, which a lot of people couldn't believe that the Mets trade a guy after winning the Cy Young Award. But you win the Gold Glove in 2013. You lead all American League pitchers, 40 assists, 7 defensive runs saved, and you only gave up 8 stolen bases. To what do you attribute your fielding prowess, R.A.?
You know, I think that goes back to just being an athlete. I was a quarterback when I played in high school and played basketball in high school and, you know, played shortstop when I didn't pitch. And, you know, I always felt like, you know, both at the plate and on the mound, if I could be better than the guy across from me, then I had an advantage. So why not work at it? You know, that was my mentality. And so, you know, I'll never forget taking Timmy Tuffle on the backfield and having him hit me comebacker after comebacker after comebacker every spring training, just trying to refine my skills, because I knew that with the knuckleball, so many times the hitter was going to miss hit it. He was going to hit pieces of it. And so if I could field my position better than anybody else, that was just going to, you know, be another bullet in my gun. And so I worked really hard at that, where maybe most guys take it for granted. A lot of guys take it for granted. I really built that into kind of who I wanted to be as a pitcher and who I saw myself as an athlete, and it paid off. I mean, I think I could have, you know, I felt like that was something I took a lot of pride in. I felt like I could have won that award a few different times, but it was something that I really enjoyed doing too. You know, I really enjoyed the challenge of you know, being able to field bunts right, holding runners close, not giving up stolen bases, controlling the running game. All those things that would contribute to a championship team, I wanted to make sure that I could do those things. And so I would work real hard at that and have great teachers. You know, Chip Hale, who was a great teacher of mine with the Mets, as well as Tim Tuffle. I mean, all those guys were great for me.
Well, you, as you say, you honed your craft as a pitcher, and you did as a fielder as well. And it really showed, and it really paid off. Now, you had said earlier that you're an avid reader, and you would have been an English professor had you not become a professional athlete.
That's true. I think I probably would have been a coach in there too along the way. But I, you know, the people that made the biggest impact in my life were teachers and coaches. You know, and so when I thought about my life outside of baseball, it was hard for me not to think about myself in a way that would be trying to positively impact young people. And so that was kind of where I thought I might end up. And now here in Nashville, Tennessee, presently, you know, I get to coach. I'm the pitching coach of a local high school here and really get to enjoy pouring into those young men. And my sons, who is my oldest son, and was with me as a, you know, running around City Field with me when he was a youngster, I get to coach him in high school now. So things have come full circle in a lot of ways, and I'm certainly very blessed and so happy about it.
Now, your walk-up song, I mean, Pete Alonso's got Layla, Francisco Lindor's got my girl, and R.A. Dickey has the theme from Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah, that was I always liked that orchestral instrumentation that led into the series, and so it would kind of get me in a zone, so to speak, so that I felt like you know, I always wanted to, I named all my bats after, you know, swords and literature. And so I would go up there with this kind of mentality that I was not going to strike out. I was going to use my bat, my sword, to try to help us win a game. And so that put me in my happy place, I think, when I got to the plate.
Real neat, R.A. Now, you risked your salary to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. I'm sure there's a lot of fans out there that don't know about that. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, that was something that was one of the, you know, great privileges, I think, of my life when I reflect on it. It was just an opportunity to raise money for an organization that fought human trafficking. And, you know, if people know my story, you know, I share a similar wound with that space, if you will. And it was very cathartic for me in a lot of ways. You know, I hiked to the top of Kilimanjaro, and we were able to raise over $150,000 to build a medical clinic in the middle of the red light district in India for prostitutes that had been trafficked over there. And it was an unbelievable experience. I took my daughters over there the next year, and we were able to serve at the very clinic that we raised the money to build. And so it was just a real great experience. Dave Racanello, who's the bullpen catcher for the New York Mets, went with me, as well as another guy who was a really dear friend of mine named Kevin Slowey. And the three of us together were able to do it and succeed in doing it, and also, more importantly, raise money for something that we all thought was an important cause.
What an amazing story that is. Now, I want to mention your autobiography, R.A. Folks can still pick that up. Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and The Perfect Knuckleball, folks. That is a great read. It's written along with a guy who's been on the show with us before, Wayne Coffey from the New York Daily News. It's from 2012, I believe, but the message is still strong. I agree with that, R.A.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. And Wayne Coffey's a dear friend. He was incredible in that process. And, you know, it's one of the things that I hope people remember about me and my legacy as a New York Met. Is just, you know, I always, my whole desire was just to try to inspire hope. You know, I mean, that was something that I was given. I felt like as just tried to be as hopeful as I could about what the future might have, despite maybe some adversity that we all end up going through to some degree. And that book was written with that end in mind, just to try to give people as much hope as I could.
Find that on Amazon, folks. It's a great read. And aside from your coaching, which is real important to you, R.A., what else keeps you busy these days?
Well, I'm a father of four, and, you know, it's that being a full-time husband and father to a wife who, you know, she sacrificed a lot to follow me around for 21 years of professional baseball. I get to, you know, knock out a lot of things around. We have a 40-acre farm here in Nashville, so I get to knock out a lot of things for her and things I enjoy. But, you know, that keeps me really busy, is chasing my children around and trying to keep up with the farm and coaching baseball. And I'm also involved in a local anti-human trafficking coalition here called the Nashville Anti-Human Trafficking Coalition. I'm on the board of, and we do a lot of things in the community that are really dear to me, so I get to do that as well. But I'm plenty busy.
A full life, a life well lived, R.A. That sounds exactly a description of you right now. Well, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you with us, R.A. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us back here in New York. I wish the best to you and the family and with your coaching career, and happy farming.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
That is the great R.A. Dickey, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll switch gears and speak to the wonderful singer-songwriter Leslie Mendelson. So stick around, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we are back. We're back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB AM/FM radio, live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York. We are just down the block from the train station, and there's a carnival going on tonight at the train station. I think Brian and I are going to go up there and have a few funnel cakes and hit the Tilt-A-Whirl. Right, Brian? Yeah, that's what we're going to do when we're done here. So right now we're going to switch gears, which we do on occasion, and move over from sports to music. We always concentrate on the importance of homegrown talent and music. There is, and there always has been, a plethora of talent from our local area. And in the past, we've spoken to Russell Javers and Liberty DeVito from Billy Joel's original band, John the Cat Gatto from the Good Rats, who else? Felix Cavallari from the Young Rascals, J.J. French from Twisted Sister, Roger Earl from Foghat. Most recently, we had Randy Jackson from Zebra on the show. Such a goldmine of musical talent in our own backyard, as it were. Tonight, we continue bringing you another magnificent artist with roots local to Long Island. Our next guest, she is a South Setauket, born and raised Grammy Award-nominated singer-songwriter. She is on tour presently in support of her new album, which is titled After the Party, and that album was produced by the great Peter Asher, the talented Tyler Chester, along with her songwriting partner, Steve McEwen. Himself is a three-time Grammy winner. She will be headlining the Stephen Talk House in Amagansett this coming Saturday night. That's May 31st. And I'd like to welcome to the show tonight Leslie Mendelson. Leslie, good evening.
Hey, guys. Great
to have you with us, Leslie. Maybe you could come to the carnival with us when we're done here and hit the Ferris wheel, perhaps. What
All
do
right.
you think?
Sure. Okay. Sure, Charlie. Come on, let's
yeah.
do it.
Yeah. Now, we're a sports show as our roots, Leslie, so I want to ask you, you went to Ward Melville. Did you know or have you ever heard of Steven Matz or Marcus Stroman, the major league pitchers?
But can I just give you a little info? I used to share our backyards touched Randy Jackson from Zebra.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was friends with his daughter, and so it's just really funny that you mentioned his name. So there's some just a little connection
yeah,
there.
Yeah, we had Randy on a week or two ago. Yeah, because they played the Westbury Music Fair, about a week ago. So that's why we wanted to talk to Randy. So
yeah, my sports knowledge is pretty bad, but let's go Mets and
Yay.
Let's go Knicks. You know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Now, what was life growing up in South Setauket for you like?
Oh, it was just wild, Bill. So much to do, so much to get in trouble.
Oh yeah. But,
you know, yeah, it was fine. You know, I was like such a normal childhood, suburban USA, you know. And then, you know, at some point after high school, I started thinking about, you know, maybe moving into the city just to work, you know, do music. Well, anywhere, really. I just wanted to be honest. I just wanted to get the hell out. I wanted to, like,
yeah.
tour. So, you know, but I have to say I grew up on a great block. A lot of kids used to play kickball and just, you know, just everybody riding bikes. You know, we stayed out all day. We never went home.
Right, yeah. Your parents didn't know where the heck
we're
you were.
We're just left alone.
Yeah.
We're just latchkey kids.
You could have been out like we were, making a bomb or riding to you know, a town 30 miles away, but your parents didn't know. They thought you were over your buddy's house or something.
Yeah, and my dad, at some point, he would just get sick of shouting for me, so he bought an air horn. And I knew it was, and everybody would laugh at me. It was so embarrassing. It was like, oh, let's leave to go home. Yeah. Like, Dad, what's with the air horn?
Oh, that's great.
It's like, why don't you get a cowbell or something?
Yeah.
It is ready.
Now, when did you decide, Leslie, that you'd like to make music your career path? And who were some of your early musical influences?
Oh, let's see. I think, you know, I got hit with the Beatles bug real
everybody,
early.
Everybody tells
I know.
Me that.
How
yeah.
can you not? It's so cliche, but I don't care because it's the best. You know,
yeah.
and I had this great songbook. We had a piano growing up. I took a couple lessons. I kind of had a good ear. I used to, like, just hear things on the radio or TV and run over and try to learn them. And finally, the parents were like, let's get her some lessons. And, you know, they were fine, the lessons. But I just remember when I had this great book of, like, it was like an anthology of every single Beatles song. And those were the chords, and I could, you know, and they were all in the correct keys. It was really well done. And I feel like I worked my way through that, and I think that was probably what put me on track to, like, try, you know, just kind of getting the shape of songs and figuring out that kind of stuff on the piano. And then anything like pop music, but I was really probably drawn to Carole King growing up and Joni Mitchell later on and Bob Dylan and rock and roll. I had a friend who grew up in Setauket, because I guess it was Warren Melville. Yeah, and she lived over in Strong's Neck, and she had hippie parents, and they used to play rock and roll, and I was a bit square, you know, and then she was the one who kind of introduced me to rock and roll and, like, all the great records, and that opened my eyes to this more.
Yeah. Favorite Beatles song?
Ugh. Honestly, it's probably Something.
Okay. Yeah, mine is a more obscure And Your Bird Can Sing.
Song.
A little more obscure, but I wait for that on the Beatles.
Well, at least you didn't say you know my name, look up the number.
Yeah.
Or I want you, she's so heavy.
Everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey.
I just listened to the whole White Album just recently, just put it on and listened to it. My God, there's some of the greatest songs on those albums.
That's a wild one, yeah. Now, I want to read a quote from Jackson Browne, who said that Leslie's melodies are timeless. They reach me way back in my youth somewhere. I hear traces of Burt Bacharach and Carole King and Hook's passages that remind me of the pop songs I grew up hearing on the radio. Now, that's pretty high
praise. That was nice. That was pretty nice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was really nice that he did that. I actually recorded the record after the party, you know, with Peter Asher. We did it in his studio. And I've been friends with him for a few years because back in 2019, we did a duet together for a movie called 5B. We wrote a song together, and Steve McEwen called A Human Touch. So we've been friends since then. He also put it on his latest record, which was super cool. So, yeah, we've been in touch. He's lovely, and I've toured with him, a couple tours opening for him, and then coming out and singing the duet with him on stage. And he's just, you know, it's amazing working with your idols, because I grew up, he was another one, just, you know, I played piano for most of my childhood, and then I think I picked up acoustic guitar around 16. And these days, his song, These Days, was one of the first songs I learned on the guitar. So nice. I've been listening to him forever.
Now, the Peter Asher, I was a little confused at first. Is this the Peter Asher of Peter and Gordon and Jane Asher's brother? Okay, yeah. A great guy in his own right. Yeah, Peter Asher.
He's a great producer. Yeah, he did, James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt. He made some of my favorite records, and I actually met him. I was invited to a dinner, and I actually sat next to Jackson and Peter, kind of like in a table. There was other people, but I happened to sit down next to them, and I was just like, I'm just like at the cornerstone of a lot of music history right here.
Yeah.
And it was after that dinner, I was ready to make my record, and he was interested in hearing some of the demos of some of the songs I had written with Steve, and I sent it over, and he was interested in working, and I didn't, you know, I thought that was such a cool, great opportunity, so I took it.
Nice,
and we did it, yeah.
Now the band that you worked with, it's got Waddy Wachtel in it, who... he's worked with a guy named Keith who plays in the greatest rock band in the world, probably.
Yeah, what's their name?
Yeah.
What's their name?
Leland Sklar, who's a great bass player. Jim Keltner. How important is your collaboration with these talented guys to you, Leslie?
Well, when Peter was asking me who I wanted to be on the record, I started thinking about all my favorite records, and I knew Peter had access to them. So I just said, well, what about, this is my dream band. And I, you know, I mentioned Leland and Jim and Waddy. Well, I have another story about Waddy. He's actually an old family friend. My dad and him went to high school together and played in a band. Yeah, but then they reconnected years later, but he's kind of Uncle Waddy now. But I never had a chance to work with him because, you know, he's a busy guy. But then I was putting the record together, and I just mentioned these guys, and they were all into it. And I'll tell you, Bill, they couldn't have been nicer. You get in the studio, and they just, there's a reason these guys are legends. Not only do they play beautifully and know how to make records, they just made me feel comfortable. And because it was easy to make music with them, I just felt good, and we had a great time.
We're speaking with Leslie Mendelson tonight on the program. Now, other collaborations of yours, Leslie, more rock royalty, Bob Weir, and you opened for The Who at Madison Square Garden. What were those two guys like?
Well, working with Bob was great because, you know, I grew up on Long Island, and I always think, like, you know, there weren't that many bands growing up, but I felt like there was like top 40 bands and jam bands.
Yeah. You know?
So I feel like, and I kind of leaned a little bit more to the Dead side, and I just love that songbook. So I kind of grew up playing Grateful Dead music. And then, you know, years later, I had this opportunity to work with Bob. He invited me to be a guest on his show, We're Here, which was a web series he did back in 2010 to maybe 12, somewhere around there, maybe even later. I think 14 or, oh, I even did it. I can't remember. It was around that time. And he would invite artists to come and sing with him at his studio with a band. And when I did it, we did my songs, we did his songs, we did some covers. And then between sets, he sits at a desk like David Letterman and interviews people. And it was Steve Parrish on the couch with me and Dave School. So you can imagine like two mountainous men and me in the middle.
Yeah.
But we got into some fun conversation, a lot of road stories. I was just sitting there. So I'm like, what am I doing here? But it was a good laugh. And the music was great. And I made some lasting friendships. Another Long Islander, Jason Crosby, was in the band, and a collaborator of mine because of that night is Steve Kimmock, who is actually a Pennsylvania native, but he played in Rat Dog and tons of stuff, Dead Adjacent, and that was that time. It was great. Still going on.
Now, after the party, of course, folks, is Leslie's new album. Let's talk about some of the tracks on the album, Leslie. How about the title track, After the Party? It feels both nostalgic yet new.
That's it. You nailed it.
Yeah.
That was my goal. No, you know, that's actually my favorite song on the record. And it feels like, I even quote the Crimson and Clover kind of vibe, because it's very much dreamy like that.
Uh-huh.
And we played it live in the studio. I sang and played, and we kept that track. I'm playing acoustic guitar, Waddy's on guitar, electric guitar, and Jim. And that was such a, I don't know, it's just, it felt like the vibe actually came from an Andy Warhol painting of the same name, After the Party, and I was looking at it one day. It was probably during the pandemic, and I hadn't seen anybody in, I don't know, a little while. And I was thinking, I want to be at that party. So I kind of invented a scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, it works.
Thanks.
That's for sure. Now, Other Girls. Now,
yeah.
That's kind of wild. I was listening to that, and it's, to you kids out there, it's suggestive. So go listen to it.
It's a play on just like a concept of just turning jealousy on its head and having a little fun with it. It was actually almost a joke song, but then we got the song to the point where I'm like, oh, I think this is a jam. So it is. Oh, it's very tongue in cheek.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Brian, you have that. Let's take a listen, Leslie, to After the Party. You want to introduce it?
The call letters.
WGBB.
We're listening to WGBB on Long Island, and here's a new tune from Leslie Mendelson. This is After the Party.
Nice.
Oh, I didn't hit the post! And the weather is 69 degrees in D.C.
After the party.
There, nailed it.
Music's not over. Jukebox is playing. Crimson and clover, and I adore. Take out our cameras. People posing for pictures. Make it look like we're glamorous. And I don't wanna go home. No, I don't.
Not only does that song speak to people, Leslie, what a lovely voice.
Thanks. Thank you.
And I tried to contact Peter through his SiriusXM email or through the generic email that they throw out there to get a quote from him. I'd like to have Peter on the show as well. But he's coming up. He's busy planning his own show at the City Winery. Coming up,
yeah.
So he'll be there.
He's got a great one-man show. Yeah,
He must have some great stories about Jane and Paul. And, oh, man, just
Everyone. Yeah. Everyone. He's done it all. He's seen it all.
What Peter said is Leslie is one of the very rare singers who can combine elegant precision with the soul and emotional resonance of a deeply moving writer and performer. She has a remarkable voice, as I said, and one we need to hear. So a great quote from your producer.
Not bad.
What else is coming up for you, Leslie?
Well, this summer I got some stuff. I think like July 3rd, I'm opening for the Milk Carton Kids at Rockaway Beach. And I'm going to be, I have some shows around, but I'm mostly going to be focusing on recording. Mm-hmm. I want to start my next record, and I bought a bunch of gear. I'm teaching myself some stuff, you know, like how to record, and I've never done that, so I'm definitely diving into a very large pool. I'm going to try to swim in it, but I think it's, you know, important for, I think, anybody that's a musician to learn that language, so that's kind of my goal this summer, is to work on that.
Now, the band that's on the record, will they be at Stephen Talkhouse this weekend?
No, but I'm going to have a killer band. Okay. Andy Hess on bass and Tony Leone. He plays in Little Feet and The Ramble, at, you know, up at Levon Helms, and he plays with just tons of people. He's great. They're both amazing. So we've got Tony Leone on drums, Andy Hess on bass, and then my co-writer, Steve McEwen. He's going to be playing guitar and singing, and I'm going to have some keys and vocals and, you know.
Yeah.
Just make a party out of it.
Sounds
wonderful.
We'll
do originals. We'll do covers. I'll, you know, talk some crap, and we'll have some fun.
Anybody yell Free Bird, what would you do?
I'd play it. That song's great. No, I don't know. I actually had to play it. I learned it for a funeral.
Oh, God. Really? Oh,
it's a very
boy.
Sad song. I had to stop when the ending, you know, when it like kind of
revs
like,
up.
Yeah, that's good enough now.
Well, I want to mention again, coming up this Saturday, it's May 31st. Stephen Talkhouse in Amagansett, Leslie Mendelson and her kick-ass band will be there promoting the new album, which is called After the Party. And then if you're living towards the city, Leslie's performing at the Rockaway Hotel. That's in East New York, and that's on July 3rd. You can catch her there. So a lot of opportunity to see Leslie. Go out to Stephen Talkhouse. It's a great place.
Yeah. So much fun.
Paul McCartney showed up there one night and did I Saw Her Standing There, and just an incredible vibe that was. I wasn't there, but it was well publicized.
Yeah, you never know. Paul could come back.
Yeah. You never know, Leslie. Keep an eye on the audience.
Okay.
And that's it. Well, Leslie, it's been a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at
WGBB.
Thanks
so much for having me.
No worries. And don't forget, folks, Stephen Talkhouse in Amagansett on Saturday night. All the best to you, Leslie.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Brian.
You take care now.
See you soon. Okay.
Oh, wait. Where can folks get tickets? Where can folks get tickets for the show? That's what I've forgot.
That's great. So my name, Leslie Mendelson. That's Leslie Mendelson, Mendelson. You can go there, .com. There's tickets there, and Facebook, Instagram. You know, there's links everywhere. It's very findable. Just Google it. You can even just Google my name and Talkhouse. It'll come up.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks again, Leslie, and everybody will see you out at Stephen Talkhouse.
Sounds great. See you. Bye. Thank you.
That's Leslie Mendelson, ladies and gentlemen. So we had a great time tonight. We had, who did we have, Brian? Oh, gee. R.A. Dickey. Great chat with R.A. Dickey and his knuckleball. And the great collaboration. Tonight's theme was really collaboration with R.A. Dickey, Tim Wakefield, Phil Necro, Charlie Huff, and just talking the knuckleball. And then we had Leslie talking about her collaboration with Jackson Brown, with Waddy Wachtel, who, of course, plays with Keith Richard And just a great night. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests one more time. R.A. Dickey, Leslie Mendelson, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. I'll see you next Sunday, June 8th. Not next Sunday. It's a few Sundays away, June 8th. We'll have some more sports talk that night. Till then, be safe and be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.